With my chair, there we go.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare. It is Wednesday, April 29th, and since Representative Lively's here, let's just temporarily open House Bill 2638. And we'll be jumping around because we have senators wanting to and representatives wanting to testify.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2638 expands the use of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program to include medical assistance recipients and coordinated care organizations. It allows the Oregon Health Authority to deny reimbursement of Legend drugs until 6 months after the United States Food and Drug Administration approval. There is a dash one amendment which removes the ability of the Oregon Health Authority to deny reimbursement for Legend drugs until 6 months after the United States Food and Drug Administration approval or Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee approval. There is no revenue impact on the introduced bill and indeterminate fiscal impact on the introduced bill.
Great. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Lively. I'm House District 12 representative. That's from Springfield. I'm here to speak just briefly about House Bill 2638. A year and a half or maybe longer, some of us locally in Lane County met a couple times talking about health care costs and what were driving costs. And one of the things that kept rising to the forefront was pharmaceuticals and what pharmaceuticals cost. We talked about options of what we might be able to do to talk at the state level to address it, and most of those options are not attainable in the near term. And so this is a step, hopefully, in the right direction to start addressing it versus trying to do more. The cost of prescription drugs remains a major cost driver to our healthcare system and the long-term success of bending the cost curve or even providing adequate coverage. House Bill 2638 is one small step to identify and provide savings for recipients throughout Oregon. The Oregon Prescription Drug Program, OPDP, and I'll say it a dozen different ways, but that's what I mean each time I say it, provides drugs at discounts to individuals who have no insurance or whose insurance does not cover drugs. OPDP also provides discounted drugs for PEB, some OEB members, OHSU, Salem Hospital, and other groups throughout the state. OPDP joined Washington Prescription Drug Program to form the Northwest Prescription Drug Consortium. Through the combined purchasing power of the consortium, both states have benefited from savings on purchases of prescription medications. This bill removes the restrictions prohibiting the OHA to purchase prescription drugs directly or indirectly through this authority for recipients of Medicaid, therefore expanding the use of OPDP to include Medical Assistance Program, the MAP. If CCOs are permitted to access OPDP, CCOs would contract with the pharmacy benefit manager, which could result in some potential savings for CCOs through the group pricing, and CCOs could save on their costs of contracting with the PBM to perform the work. It's one small step, but I believe that it would help to start bringing down some of the costs and certainly provide, from my standpoint, it's an important resource for the CCOs to provide some access, reducing their costs that they currently are spending on drugs to provide to Medicaid patients. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you. Representative, I'm not quite I know we're trying to save costs, but the part where it's prohibited for the first 6 months after approval, why that?
That was primarily, Chair and Senator Cruz, primarily driven from what we saw last year, most recently with the new drugs that are coming out that are enormously expensive and the inability to plan for the cost of those drugs when they're first announced. Because the reality is that the cost of some of those drugs when they're first approved and come out, the cost of those far exceeds the amount of money that's available. So the pressure that puts on CCOs or OHA to be able to provide those early on before we've provided for them, it just eats up money that's not available for the broader cross-section of providing medications.
So they drop in price in 6 months?
No, they would not. Only 6 months just provides some time in which to try to prepare to how we're going to address paying for those costs. Mm-hmm. Does not mean that the price would change necessarily in 6 months. Only gives us a ramped up time in which to try to address the costs.
And if I may, Senator Cruz, it also gives experts a chance to weigh in on when it's most appropriate to use those new drugs, which they won't have a chance to do before they come to market. So, you know, those things take a little while to get people to put together the best advice about when's most appropriate to prescribe those drugs.
Well, that would, if I could, Madam Chair, that would seem to me that, that when these drugs are approved, it's a surprise to everybody and nobody knows they're coming. I mean, I would assume that, that that's general knowledge.
Actually, it's some of both, if I may.
Yeah.
Sometimes the FDA works in mysterious ways, to say the least. And sometimes you get lots of notice about when it's coming, and sometimes not so much. And you're not always sure which indications are going to get approved right away and which indications they're going to ask for more information on. So until a drug has actually been officially released by the approved by the FDA for specific indications, it's often impossible to know which guidelines you need to be working on. Speaking from long and difficult personal experience.
Thank you, Representative Lively. We'll be going more into this because Pharma has come forward with an amendment to delete lines 44 and 45 on page 3, and then all of page 5 and, well, all of section 3. But we will have that conversation later. Thank you, Representative Lively. I want to, I know that Representative Kenny Geyer wants to quickly talk about 3041, so I will temporarily open House Bill 3041.
There's a lot of House members here.
And, oh, and Representative Bueller, too, then. And then his bill is next.
Okay.
Wait, which side of the, which committee? I think they're all on health care, and they need to get back there. No, health care isn't meeting. You're human services?
Human
meeting?
Services.
Yes. Okay.
Sharing that right now. We're both on that committee, so thank you for hearing us. For the record, I'm Representative Alyssa Kinney-Geyer, House District 46 from Northeast and Southeast Portland. I'm honored here to be alongside my health colleagues. We've got several bills. We've got a lot coming over to you. This one that we are here in support of is House Bill 3041 relating to sun protection in schools. Skin cancer, as you may know, is one of the deadliest forms of cancer in the United States. It affects many Oregonians, and it has affected me and my own family very profoundly. My mother died of skin cancer. My brother and sister both had melanoma, and I've had squamous cell cancer. Oregon has a disproportionately high rate of melanoma compared to the rest of the country, interestingly enough. We have the fifth highest incidence of melanoma in the country and the fourth highest death rate from melanoma. Yet many Oregonians are not aware of the dangers to themselves or to their children. Childhood overexposure to ultraviolet radiation is the leading cause of skin cancer. Up to 40% of an individual's lifetime UV exposure occurs by age 20. Young people spend a substantial portion of their lives in schools, and some of that time is spent outside during sunny hours of the day. Just one blistering sunburn during childhood doubles a person's lifetime risk of developing melanoma. While skin cancer is one of the deadliest forms of cancer, thankfully, it is also the most preventable. HB 3041 is a common sense bill that fixes an Oregon statute to permit access to sun protection and sunscreen for kids during school hours and at school activities. While state statutes and rules are clear about over-the-counter medications like Tylenol, there is not guidance for schools when it comes to non-prescription sunscreen. Currently, it is unclear whether schools can allow students to bring and use sunscreen in school. You have the Dash 3 amendments before you. OHSU has worked with Oregon School Board Association on these Dash 3 amendments in order to provide our school boards and schools the flexibility they need to implement this legislation as easily as possible. These amendments help clarify the current policies and rules in place regarding inappropriate clothing. HB 3041 will remove unnecessary barriers for Oregon's children's access to sun protection while at school. It is important for parents to have the option to send their kids to school with sunscreen and to give schools clarity around this issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson. For the record, my name is Representative Newt Bueller from House District 54, and I'm very proud to be a co-sponsor with my colleague from Southeast and Northeast Portland. Just briefly, I want to give you the origin of the bill. I'm very proud to say it was brought to us by OHSU medical students who were very interested in learning about the legislative process. They researched a number of different public health issues and landed on this as one common sense solution that they could work on. And I think it's a great opportunity for them to learn the process. You know, as we know, sometimes the process can be intimidating for people, especially people who haven't spent much time in the Capitol. They've researched the topic. They've advocated. They've talked to us. They've gotten co-sponsors. They've worked through amendments, all the things that good legislation produces. And I think it's really been a wonderful learning experience as medical students, not only to learn the science of medicine, but also the politics of medicine. And I think increasingly as science and healthcare issues play a bigger and bigger role in society, we need those types of professionals understanding how to engage and be very productive partners in this process. So I think that's another great part of this legislation, and I certainly would encourage and urge your support and encouragement to them also to continue to be actively involved. Thank you very much.
Questions for the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I would like to open House Bill 2605A. Representative Nose.
Madam Chair, committee members, House Bill 2605A directs the Department of Consumer and Business Services to convene a stakeholder work group to consider modifying the standard for the rate review process that specifies issues to be reviewed. It directs DCPS to make a preliminary decision to approve, disapprove, or modify rate filing, to notify the insurer of a preliminary decision, and to make the public the preliminary decision. It establishes the grievance process if the insurer does not agree with the decision, and specifies that DCBS is to issue an order of the decision no later than 30 days following the preliminary decision. There is no amendment and no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
And we need to call. Isn't he for 20? Would you like him to hear? I heard we wanted Peter Ricoy to hear.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. To be a part of from the beginning. Yeah. Hi, Peter. This is Senator Lori Montes Anderson. We are on live in our health care committee. Representative Nose is going to introduce the bill, and then we will have you testify.
Fantastic, Senator. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right. Representative Nose.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Montes Anderson. For the record, my name is Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42, which is inner southeast and northeast Portland, and I'm happy today to be here before you to kick off testimony and discussion about House Bill 2605. The bill passed out of the House Healthcare Committee with bipartisan support, and it also passed on the House floor with 56 yes votes. And the bill is a result of extensive discussions between the Insurance Division, Oregon's Health Co-op, Osberg, and several health insurance companies, including Cambia Health. And I'd like to personally thank the Insurance Commissioner, Laura Calley, and Jeanette Hallman from the Insurance Division, Doug Riggs and Ralph Prowse, and Peter Ricoy from the co-op for their time and effort helping me with this bill. It wouldn't have been possible without their extensive cooperation, and also the help I got from Tom Holt, who represents Cambia Health, and Jesse at Osberg. I think they're all here. So House Bill 2605, it arose out of a situation in which Oregon's Health Co-op, which is a member-owned health insurance company, they had a disagreement with the Insurance Division over what rate they'd be allowed to charge for their plans, with the co-op feeling they ought to be able to charge less, and the Insurance Division felt was appropriate or prudent. So in the end, the Insurance Commissioner imposed a modified rate on the co-op that the co-op did not like. And given the statutes and the rules around the current rate-setting process, the co-op felt like they were left with very few options. They were worried that they'd have to forgo offering insurance and participating on the exchange. Now, under the current process, there is an ability for an insurance company to appeal the rate that the insurance commissioner sets, but it's done under the Administrative Procedures Act, and I'm told that availing yourself of that process can take a long time. Essentially, pursuing that formal appeal process makes it hard to have your insurance plan with the rate you hope to have available on the exchange in a timely manner. So to that end, this bill addresses the concern of the health co-op and other insurance companies by creating a process for rate discussion within the Insurance Commission that does not presently exist. So in a nutshell, here's what the bill does. An insurance company must submit their desired rates or premium costs. The insurance division then issues a preliminary discussion regarding insurance rates after reviewing an insurance company's rate filing and their rationale for it. Insurers, any person affected or aggrieved by the preliminary decision by the insurance division, can then meet with the insurance division to discuss their concerns with that preliminary rate decision. The bill also allows an insurer to accept the modified rate proposed by the insurance commissioner while pursuing an administrative appeal at the same time. This new process, allowing for the acceptance of the modified rate and the ability to pursue an appeal at the same time, means the insurer can participate in the exchange while still retaining their right to appeal a decision they disagree with. The bill also allows for an expedited process in which an insurer could go directly to the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services regarding their rate proposal. They could pursue the additional appeal if they would like, but this expedited process allows them to have a second look at that modified rate before they have to enter the insurance exchange for the coming year. Lastly, like a lot of things around here, on a few points where there was some mild contention and which all the stakeholders, we weren't able to reach a consensus, the insurance division has agreed to convene a work group of those stakeholders and issue some recommendations later this year on how to address the concerns that we just couldn't resolve through statute with the process. I think Lori Freeman from LC is here. I didn't see her, but maybe she's sitting in the back. Or oh, there she is. Okay. And there are other experts here, including Peter Recoy on the phone. So if you have a pretty technical question, I'd actually ask you to defer to them. I can answer some, but I think my chair of rules would also like me to get down to her committee as well. So I like this bill a lot. I was happy to work on it, and I hope you'll pass it.
Well, for a freshman, you jump right in and go into a rate review.
Which, I was telling Senator Cruz and Senator Noak the other day that I've been, surprised at how it takes 9 months to work on a bill that most people agree is a good idea. I mean, it's a lot of work.
It's never easy.
I mean, I didn't have any, I think the Insurance Commission and the parties were great to work with, but it took a lot of time to figure it out nonetheless.
Great. All right. Let's thank you. And Doug Riggs, Lori Kelly, and
Peter
Fawn. Barry, okay. And let's start next with Peter Recoy.
Well, thank you, Senator, and I just wanted to thank the committee for considering the issue of the bill. And I mostly wanted to also recognize and thank the very hard work that Representative Nose, Laura Calley, Jeanette Holman, and Jesse O'Brien all worked very hard on coming together to talk about a bill that would make sense for the various parties and in a way that made sense to Oregonians as well. I think that Representative Nose laid out nicely what are the issues that the bill sought to address, and I mostly wanted to make myself available today to the committee to answer any technical questions that do come up, and I would be happy to do so. And I also should have mentioned at the beginning, I'm here on behalf of Oregon's Health Co-op, who also worked very hard on this bill to bring it together in the form that you see today. So that concludes what I wanted to say orally. And again, I mostly wanted to make myself available here today for any questions that may arise. And thank you again for your consideration of the measure.
Thank you very much. And just hold tight. We'll see if there's any questions. Laura, do you want to?
Sure. Pardon me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Peter, you didn't say your name, so could you please say your name for the record?
Yes. My name is Peter Recoy, R-I-C-O-Y, and I'm an attorney with Schwabe, Williamson & Wyatt, and I'm representing Oregon's Health Co-op.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Calley, and I'm the insurance commissioner with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I won't go into the detail. I think that Representative Nose and Peter did a great job of giving an overview of the bill. But just wanted to mention that this really has been a collaborative process, and we really do appreciate the work of Representative Nose and the other stakeholders to talk about this over the last several months. I did want to point out a couple of things that just I think may be of interest to the committee in terms of some of the issues that this bill addresses, and just let you know kind of some things that the insurance division is putting into place for the current rate review period that are reflected here to kind of reinforce those things, and then one of the key things that it changes that the division agrees is a good idea. So when Representative Nose talked a little bit about changes in the process to allow for a discussion of the preliminary decision, right now under the current rate review statutes, we have the flexibility to really determine kind of what exactly the timeline looks like, and we do currently hold hearings on all of our rate filings. What we've decided to do for the upcoming rate filing period, which actually kicks off this Friday, is that we are going to issue a preliminary decision after the our first review of the filing. Our public comment period is going to remain open, and then we're going to hold the hearing after our preliminary decision, which will give both insurance companies and the public a better opportunity to really discuss the elements of the filing and the elements of the decision, and to be able to talk about maybe from the insurer's perspective areas where they may disagree with the division, and also from the public's perspective to raise issues that maybe they believe should have been considered in the decision, or to support some of the elements of that the preliminary decision reflects. So I do want to mention that that's a change that we've implemented really after some discussion with stakeholders about debriefing on last year's rate review. And we do think it's really important that whatever discussion of the preliminary decision occurs, that it happen in a public setting, so that it's not just about working with the insurance company to make sure that they understand the division's decision and the analysis that we performed, but that the public understand that. It's a really core piece of the transparency that underlies our rate review process. I think the one piece I do want to highlight that really does require a change, and this bill would accomplish that, is providing a more expedient way for an insurer or other aggrieved party to challenge a final decision. As Representative Nose mentioned, under the current law, if someone is truly concerned with the final decision that the division makes, it does go through a lengthy process that is actually carried out through the Office of Administrative Hearings, not through DCBS, and so it really doesn't provide a meaningful opportunity for resolution before open enrollment starts. And so this bill would provide an opportunity to accomplish that. You know, we hope that this the changes to the process about providing the preliminary decision and being very clear about the reasons for that decision will eliminate the need for that, but it would be good to have it there in case it's needed. And the piece that Representative Nose mentioned that needs further discussion had to do with what is an appropriate range of rates, and we are happy to have that conversation with stakeholders in the interim. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Yes, Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, so can you tell us what persons adversely affected means?
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Shields, my understanding is that persons adversely affected could be any member of the public or the insurance company. Really, anyone who may be affected by the decision that's made by the division could pursue that process. And that was something that was important to us in making sure that this was really an avenue for any party that was adversely affected.
Thank you.
And I have a question. You said you give out preliminary findings. And is that when the carriers will come forward with questions about preliminary findings, or after you've made your final decision?
Chair Monis-Anderson, so I the intent is that there will provide the preliminary decision, which will reflect all of our analysis and the correspondence that we've had back and forth with the insurer and the public comments that we received as of that time. Then we'll have a discussion, which will be the hearing, where the insurer and the public can kind of raise concerns with our decision, bring forward things that they think we should have considered but didn't, or disagree with assumptions, things like that. And then we would take all of that information, including the public comment, and we'd render a final decision. And then after the final decision, this bill would actually give the opportunity for another appeal, another layer of appeal. And so that's the real new piece here that can't exist without a change to the statute, is something that's more expedient to appeal that final decision. Does that clarify things?
Yes, then the timeline. I mean, so carriers need to know what rates they're going to be charging by a certain time, and I'm wondering, are there timelines built into this, or you just know that you'll be able to get it in an expedited manner?
So, Chair Monis-Anderson, so you're correct that there is a pretty short window, and we have a lot of work to do in that window. The way that we envision this working is that we do have a minimum time frame because we do have statutory minimums around providing a public comment period. In practice, the whole rate review period has taken about 60 days, and that includes, you know, our initial review to make sure all the documents are there, our more in-depth review, public comment, and then we have a time period after the close of public comment period to make our decision. And so that period has run about 60 days. Our belief is that if this bill passes, that will still be about a 60-day process. And then that will get us to that final decision point. And if there were a party who was adversely affected, an insurer or other member of the public, at that kind of 60-day point when we render the final decision, if they have a concern, they could file that appeal, and the expedited appeal process is another 30 days on top of that. So that takes about 90 days if there were to be an appeal. And based on the timing of when we start our process and when rates need to be finalized, we think that would be a reasonable amount of time to get those rates finalized and make sure that insurance companies had a final rate to offer in the market.
Thank you.
If I could ask one last question, Madam Chair. So help me understand the scope of the work group and what they will be considering.
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Shields. So my understanding is that it's an issue around when the insurance division decides what rates to approve. It looks at, you know, a range of what is a reasonable rate to charge for a product. I think we've talked, you know, in the past about how rate review works a little bit, and it's not an exact science. It's a projection of what will occur in the future. So what that means is there's not necessarily a right answer, but as we look at the variety of assumptions and information that goes into it, we know there's kind of a range of reasonable answers. And there was some discussion with the stakeholders in developing the bill about the division providing a very clear range of rates. And I think that's a pretty complex issue because the range of reasonableness can depend on a lot of factors that may vary from insurance company to insurance company. And so it's an issue that we had said to Representative Nose that we'd be happy to take up in the interim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Berry. Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Fawn Berry representing Moda Health. We are here today in support of House Bill 2605 and want to thank Representative Nose for his leadership on this issue. We were on record expressing some concerns about the base bill, so we just wanted to appear before the committee today to let you know that we support this bill fully and support the collaborative process that the Insurance Division and Representative Nose have put together around this issue.
Any other questions? All right. That's all we have for this bill. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2605. And do we have the paperwork and everything to go? Let's open a work session on House Bill 2605.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2605 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2605 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hill?
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Shields will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2605 and resume our public hearing on House Bill 3041. And I see Representative Greenlick in the audience. Please come forward. And who else can we come? Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. And I'm delighted to be here today on behalf of a very straightforward and simple bill, House Bill 3041, which is really a bill as a project that came out of a group of students interested in the legislative process at the medical school and asked questions about what could they do to help the process along. Skin cancers are a significant problem in Oregon, which is hard to imagine since we don't remember seeing the sun most of the time, but it's there, and it's a major problem in the state, and we had a bill on tanning studios in the last session because that was a problem for the skin cancers. This is another one. We have this strange problem nowadays that schools don't have school nurses. And consequently, the secretarial staff is frequently in charge of the medical care in a school, and they have severe restrictions on what medications students can use and what they can have with them. This is a simple bill that would allow students two things. It would allow them to bring sunscreen material along and use it during school when they go out in the playground and get out in the sun, and also allow them to have sun hats of a variety of kinds to protect the skin. Have you heard from students already? If not, you'll hear.
Not yet.
They're okay, well, you'll hear much more about the technical bill, but this is really a very simple and straightforward proposal that just seems you shouldn't have to have. It's one of those things that you shouldn't have to have a bill to make happen, but you do have to have a bill to make happen. So I urge you to listen carefully to their testimony and to move the bill onto the floor as fast as you possibly can.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Just comment. I never would have considered sunscreen to be in the medicinal family, but it's kind of like lotion, but interesting. I'm glad somebody picked up on that. Huh?
I can explain that one too at some point if you want.
It's okay. I don't need. I'll listen to the students on this one.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Representative Greenlake.
And I'll go back to the issue. Okay. Thank you all very much for having me.
Thank you, Representative. Larissa, is it Gorin and Annie Buck Master and Ishak Elkal?
I can't get out.
Well, we'd like to keep you here, Mitch, so.
Who wants to go first? Okay.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Annie Buckmaster, and I am a second-year medical student at OHSU. I live in Southeast Portland and am hoping to stay in Oregon to practice family medicine. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3041. I'd like to start by explaining where the idea for this bill came from. The Health Policy Interest Group, of which we're all members, is a group of medical students at OHSU who decided to learn the legislative process by working on a public health issue that could benefit our future patients. In that research, we discovered that there was actually an OHSU donor who had wished to distribute sunscreen at a high school sporting event to protect students from getting sunburned, but given the ambiguity in current statute, the school administrators declined the donation. So currently, school policies concerning sunscreen vary widely across Oregon because it is unclear whether students are legally allowed to bring and apply their own sunscreen at school. The reason why this may be confusing to schools is sunscreen has several active ingredients and a drug facts label and is considered an over-the-counter drug by the FDA. Oregon regulation specifically names what over-the-counter drugs, like Advil, topical steroid creams, antihistamines, etc., can be brought to school. But since sunscreen is not specifically called out on that list, schools have various policies. House Bill 3041 was designed to address these discrepancies and allow students to use non-prescription sunscreen and sun protective clothing during school hours and at school-sponsored activities. It specifically exempts sunscreen from the definition of medication, which clarifies the issue for schools and also relieves the burden on providers to write notes for sunscreen, which sometimes does happen now. It allows school districts the flexibility to adopt rules outlining how to manage the sunscreen at school, the type of clothing permitted, and protect school personnel from liability relating to the application of sunscreen. We think it's important for parents to have the option to send their kids to school with sunscreen and that schools have clarity around this issue. And we think House Bill 3041 helps address those issues.
OHSU has worked with the Oregon School Board Association on this technical fix amendment that will provide them the flexibility they need to implement this legislation as easily as possible. The Dash 3 amendments provide clear direction for school boards relating to the use of sunscreen in schools and ensure that current school policies relating to inappropriate clothing are upheld. We strongly encourage your support of House Bill 3041 with the Dash 3 amendments, and thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we will be happy to answer any questions.
Let's finish the panel first.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Isaac Alcall. I am from Senator Monis Anderson's district in Gresham, and a first-year medical student at OHSU, interested in the excitement of emergency medicine. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3041 with the Dash 3 amendments. One of the most enlightening things I've come to appreciate in medicine is an expression we've all heard, the value of an ounce of prevention. Just as we know smoking increases lung cancer risk, we know sun exposure and burns increase the risk of skin cancer. In fact, unprotected sun exposure is the most preventable risk factor for skin cancer. Research shows most of our sun exposure happens when we are children, and daily sunscreen use can cut the incidence of melanoma in half. To investigate further into schools' policies, I called 10 different schools all across the state. I found that while they were very forthcoming about their policies regarding things like Tylenol, many hesitated at the question when I brought up sunscreen, and their answers varied widely, some refusing to answer the question entirely. Here are some facts that might be surprising. In Oregon, incidence and mortality of melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer, are increasing. We have the fifth highest rate of melanoma in the country, whereas places like California, Texas, and Florida don't even make it into the top 10. Nationwide, pediatric melanoma rates are increasing by 2% each year. And melanoma is now the most common form of cancer in young adults and the second most common in adolescents. Thankfully, we have a safe and effective way to prevent some of these cancers. Yet, while we diligently apply sunscreen on the weekends, by not allowing children to bring sunscreen to school, we leave them unprotected through the week. House Bill 3041, with the Dash 3 amendments, would protect schools that are trying to protect students from melanoma and other skin cancers. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is that good? Okay. Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Larissa Garon, and I'm a second-year medical student at OHSU, and I also have a Master's of Public Health. I went to high school in Eugene and have lived in Portland in Senator Shields, District 22, for the last 7 years. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3041 with the Dash 3 amendments. As my classmates have already mentioned, House Bill 3041 is related to skin cancer prevention among school children. This is an important public health issue because of the morbidity and mortality associated with melanoma, but it is also a financial issue. Melanoma treatment costs the country over $3 billion each year, and this cost is increasing disproportionate relative to all other cancers. Some people think that Oregon is a rainy state and that skin cancer is less of an issue here. However, we actually have a high enough UV index that the EPA recommends application of sunscreen every 2 hours. Some areas of Oregon receive more UV radiation than others, particularly areas south of the Willamette Valley and east of the Cascades. Isaac talked about the high incidence of melanoma in our state, but as Representative Kenny Geyer noted, one good thing that distinguishes melanoma from other cancers is that we can modify risk factors, especially if we act during childhood. And we know that 40% of lifetime sun exposure happens before the age of 20. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have made specific recommendations on how to prevent sunburns, including the regular use of sunscreen, for which they recommend application every 2 hours. For kids, this means reapplication is necessary by the time lunch recess rolls around. This bill will also complement legislation that increases physical education time in schools by the 2017-18 school year. We know kids will be outside more and getting more sun exposure, and we want children to be outside exercising for a variety of health reasons. This bill will help them be as sun safe as possible during that time. By allowing sunscreen in schools, we give parents the freedom to protect their children from sunburns, give schools clear instructions on how to handle sunscreens, and reduce melanoma risk in Oregon. As a parent of two children in Oregon public schools, I've experienced three different policies at three different schools. Sometimes allowing or turning a blind eye to sunscreen, sometimes instructing parents to apply sunscreen before school. As we know, this is not sufficient to protect children. And when I mentioned this project to my daughter, who's 13, she actually, on her own, saw the disconnect between I can have ibuprofen at school, but I can't have sunscreen on field day. So she also supports this bill. This issue is particularly important to melanoma survivors, several of whom have shared their stories with us as we advocated for this legislation. And while they were unable to join us to testify today, you will find written testimony from them in OLIS, which I assume you know what that is. This bill is especially meaningful to them so that they can protect their children from a deadly disease that has affected their lives so profoundly. If you have a chance, please take a minute to read their testimony. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I hope you will consider supporting HB 3041 with the -3 amendments, and we would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
And welcome, Isaac. I love to have people from Gresham here.
It's pleasure to be here.
Can you explain the -3 amendments, or should we have
We worked with Jim Green at the Oregon School Board Association on this specific amendment request, and I believe he's here with us. If you'd like to address your questions, if that's okay.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you so much for bringing this very important issue to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Green?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association here in support of the -3 amendments to House Bill 3041. Really can't add anything other than it's been a pleasure to work with Julie Hanna and the folks from OHSU to get this piece of legislation to where we can support it. Happy to answer any questions about the amendment that is before you.
What does it do?
It essentially, what it does,
Madam Chair. That's a good question.
That is a good question.
If you take a look at the original bill required school districts to adopt policies surrounding what kids could wear and medication. And you as a former school board member know that when you start asking school districts to adopt a policy, in particular around what kids can wear to school, it creates huge issues at school districts. It's like firing a football coach or changing a bus route. So we thought of an easier way to do this is to just tell school districts, you're going to use, students can use non-prescription sunscreen, and you'll allow them to wear appropriate hats and sunwear as you see at the district level. You know, in our various districts across the state, there are certain schools that are not allowed to have gang-affiliated colors. That could be red, it could be blue, it could be an NFL team, but that lets the district decide, or the school decide, rather than the district creating a policy, because it could be different for an elementary school versus a high school. The bill still accomplishes everything that the students just told you with regard to requiring school districts to have the use of sunscreen and sun protective clothing, but it gives some flexibility to the school district. It makes it very clear to all of my members across the state that when students bring non-prescription sunscreen, they are allowed to use it. And importantly, within this bill, and it was in the bill originally, and you'll see it in the amendment, it protects our staff who may be asked to apply that sunscreen to students. And I think, as one of the representatives spoke to you, we don't have very many school nurses in our schools across the state. That generally falls to either the teacher or the secretary up in the office. So we want to make sure that they are protected either from any criminal or civil action if they're applying non-prescription sunscreen. It's a very important bill. It accomplishes exactly what the proponents want to accomplish and makes it very clear to school districts, you're going to be allowed to do this as a student in our state.
Great. Thank you so much.
Any questions? All right. Yes.
Madam Chair, so it's just to school districts?
Yes. Each school district shall allow. Now, that, Madam Chair, Senator Shields, when we use the term school district in statute, that also includes the term ESDs. Education service districts are covered under that definition.
Charter schools?
No, but each school district that has a charter school would ensure that they comply with the state law. One of the things they're required to do in those charter school agreements is comply with state law. This would obviously make it state law.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the Student Second Act, I remember when my daughter, who's seven, I was taking her to Portland Parks and Rec, and they said, you know, please lather up your kid for when they arrive, but then they went swimming midday, and then the staff wouldn't feel comfortable putting the lotion on after, so it, you know, put kids in an awkward position, certainly the parents too, and potentially at risk. So maybe we can roped the city of Portland into this bill. I'm sure they'll love it.
And Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I don't represent park and rec districts or cities, so I'm here to represent school districts, and it was wonderful to work with the folks from OHSU on this to get it to where we could all support it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm a little concerned. You talk about gang colors and NFL teams in the same sentence, and outside of the Oakland Raiders, I'm not sure who you could be talking about there. So
clearly you did not grow up watching the Steelers when I grew up watching the Steelers.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Since we just got the Dash 3s, once we get the paperwork, I'll have committee administrator assign it.
Yeah. Briefly. I'm just so excited to see all the students here. I mean, I know I've said this to you before and I've talked with you before, but I'm really proud and impressed to be associated with you and to watch you doing this. You've done an amazing job with this, and you're really a credit to future physicians and to OHSU. So nice work, everybody.
From what my administrator says, we'll probably be scheduling this for May 4th. But you don't need to come back for that, but you can watch us online if you want. All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 3041 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2368.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2368 clarifies that if a person is a valid health care directive or valid power of attorney for health care, as well as a declaration for mental health treatment, the declaration takes precedence over the other document. There is no amendment and no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Great. And Bob Jundeff is the only one signed up for the bill.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundeff. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you for hearing this bill. It's a very simple bill. Maybe it's a law nerd bill. As you know, we have laws in Oregon allowing adults to plan in advance for their health care if they become incapacitated and are unable to make those decisions at the time. We have two laws of that sort. One is called an advance directive for health care, and another is called the declaration for mental health treatment. The advance directive for health care was originally passed, I think, in 1989, and 4 years later, the declaration for mental health treatment was passed. As originally passed, the health care directive specifically ruled out its use for inpatient mental health services, but it did cover medications and outpatient services. The declaration for mental health services was developed in collaboration with the Addictions and Mental Health Office and a work group of people who receive mental health services and mental health professionals. And it was designed specifically for people who have chronic disorders, who understand that from time to time they may become incapacitated and wanted to plan for that eventuality. And it covers inpatient mental health care medications and convulsive treatment. Fast forward to just a couple of years ago, and the health care directive was amended to permit its use for inpatient mental health consent. So now both of these documents allow a person to either designate their wishes for inpatient care or other types of mental health care should they become incapacitated. But there's different rules around each, and it's very possible that one individual could have both of these documents. And that raises the possibility that they may come into conflict. And so just to be as clear as possible and anticipate the possibility that could happen, it's important to designate, to make clear which of these documents would take precedent should they have a conflict. And in this case, we believe that having the declaration for mental health treatment take precedence for the very narrow areas that it covers would be preferable, both for the following reasons. One is that the declaration is specific to mental health treatment. Secondly, It has a much shorter shelf life, if you will, than an advanced care directive. Advanced care directive will stay active indefinitely if unless a person specifically revokes it, whereas the declaration of mental health treatment automatically terminates after 3 years. So it, by its nature, it's going to only be for a limited time only. And the last factor is that even though the broader health care directive covers a wide variety of health care decisions, it does not specifically mention mental health services anywhere in its in the prescribed form that a person is supposed to use when they execute one. So for all those reasons, it's our assessment that the declaration should take precedence. And we do not have a case in which this has occurred. This is really anticipating a potential problem, and that's why we brought it to you.
Great. Any comments? No discussion. Thank you, Mr. Jundeff. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2638 and open a work session on House Bill 2638.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2638 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2638 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there...
Okay, how about if I move House Bill 2368 to the floor with a due pass recommendation?
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2368 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. And who would like to carry this bill? Senator Knope, you haven't carried one for a while.
Your turn.
You want me to carry a bill?
Would you like to carry this one?
Sure.
I will then note for the record that Senator Knope will carry House Bill 2368 with that. We'll close the work session on 2368 and open a public hearing on 2638. All right. And we've already had an introduction, and I need the sign-up sheet. Okay, so let's have Josh Ballack and Jim Gardner.
Members of the committee, Chair Monis Anderson, for the record, Josh Ballack representing the Coalition of for a Healthy Oregon. We are organizations that work with 8 of the 16 CCOs across the state. Wanted to come up and give our support for the bill as written. It actually passed off the House floor 60-0, which is remarkable, mostly because they actually managed to get all 60 members on the floor all at once. And we believe that it is very consistent with our mission for lowering costs and increasing access, and we believe that it would be a really handy tool for, in the toolkit so that we can actually help our members. So with that, I'm happy for any questions. Thank you.
Questions for him? All right. Mr. Gardner is bringing forth an amendment, and so, Josh, I want you to stay there so you can give some feedback on that.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, representing Pharma, and this is an amendment that was not presented on the House side simply because we were still in the deliberation process as it moved to the House floor. I should begin by saying that Pharma does have concerns with the broader bill. I'm not going to address those concerns. They're covered in the written testimony that's on file with OLIS, so I'm going to focus on the rationale for the Dash 1 amendment. This bill has really joins two very different concepts. The first is broadening participation eligibility in OPDP to include Medicaid recipients and CCOs, which are currently not allowed to participate. The second part of the bill is very different, and it creates what I would call a six-month window of deniability following FDA approval of a new drug, like Sovaldi, like Gleevec, and allows OHA to deny reimbursement for that drug during a six-month period or until that drug has, if it is in a new therapeutic class, has been evaluated. And you will note that while the rationale that has been suggested for this is fiscal savings, the fiscal impact statement says that those are indeterminate, that the LFO cannot determine what, if any, savings would be attributable to that. Now, by way of background, in 2011, when you created the P&T committee process, a very deliberate decision was made that drugs in unevaluated therapeutic classes, would be free without restriction, without prior authorization or other restrictions. And that was a deliberate and I think a correct policy decision. This would reverse that decision for a six-month period so that when a new drug, is in a unevaluated therapeutic class, it can be denied reimbursement. And I think that raises some very serious issues on the one hand, issues of fairness and equity. If you're on the short side of that six-month period, you can face restrictions if you're a patient. If you're 6 months plus one day, that drug is available to you without restrictions. The second issue is a legal one, and that's addressed in the memorandum that I have distributed from Hogan and Lovells and Pharma, and that has to do with the federal rebate law. The federal rebate law says basically, following FDA approval, if a drug company is paying the prescribed Medicaid rebates, that drug must be available, subject in some cases to prior authorization. That is a permissible limitation. As we read this bill, it would permit OHA to deny reimbursement altogether for newly approved drugs that have met the stamp of approval from FDA for a six-month period, and we think that does raise some very serious legal issues under the federal rebate law. But principally, our objection is based on the departure from the, we think, very sound policy that was adopted in 2011, which is that the presumption of availability without restriction ought to apply until and unless the P&T committee has completed an evaluation of a new therapeutic class into which a drug may fall.
It says the authority may.
Yes.
And so it could be that in most cases they wouldn't. I think there are certain situations probably that will arise, like the Sovaldi drug that was, what, $89,000 treatment, and this would give them at least 6 months to evaluate the impact in their program.
Madam Chair, one would think that if that would result in predictable savings to the budget, that would have been quantified in the LFO report, but that report says we can't make any estimate of what those savings might be.
Okay, yes.
So I'm a little confused, Mr. Gardner. First of all, I don't think the LFO can make a prediction on savings on drugs that haven't even been released yet, so I'm not sure how we could have expected them to predict savings on drugs we don't even know exist yet. Can you help me understand that?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, that may be the case, but if that is the case, I don't think that you can make predictions on savings that are essentially speculative.
No, Mr. Gardner, if I may, Madam Chair, that's not what we're saying. We're saying that we want to be sure that if we're using taxpayer dollars to pay for medical care, we're paying for the right drugs at the right time, and I don't think we can guarantee it. But just to get to the more critical issue here, if you look at page 3 starting in line, if you look at line 29, it says the authority shall provide reimbursement for a legend drug that does not meet the criteria if, and then it goes through it, but it doesn't say that they may not prescribe. It only says that they have to provide reimbursement if that's the case. So the authority can choose if there is a situation where there's a new drug on the market that's clearly life-saving for a certain class of patients, they may choose to do it. This only requires them to pay for it if it meets all these criteria, but it doesn't say that they can't prescribe, that can't provide payment for these drugs if there are other circumstances, unless I'm misreading this language.
Madam Chair, Senator Steyer-Hayward, no, I think that is correct, but what I'm saying is that the presumption of availability that was made, that's in the existing law, says that if it's not an evaluated class, it shall be available without restriction. That's what the existing law says. And that, well, we think, is a sound policy decision.
I guess I would say, Mr. Gardner, that I would be worried if you think that the Oregon Health Authority would choose to deny payment for someone who needs a life-saving drug, even if it hasn't been on the market for 6 months, and then it will be available for them. I think that we've been given a fair amount of latitude under our waiver for our Medicaid program to set up these rules within a pretty broad range of reason, and I don't think that this would have made it past legislative council in its current form if they thought that we were going to be in violation of federal statute. I mean, I understand that you have an outside opinion, but I'd be surprised if legislative council missed something as major as a violation of federal statute.
Madam Chair, Senator Steyer-Hayward, if you look at the LFO analysis, you will see a statement that to pass muster with CMS, it has to seek certain approvals there. What I don't think is covered by that is whether or not this, in fact, would comply with those prior authorization requirements in the federal Medicaid rebate statute.
That's my point, though, Mr. Gardner. Why would legislative council have said that? I mean, they have to understand that statute, don't they?
Madam Chair, Senator Steyer-Hayward, I'm not going to speculate on the thought processes that LC goes through in drafting legislation like this. Normally, they will give a caveat if there is a constitutional problem, but I think it's asking too much of LC to expect them to engage in an exhaustive analysis of the federal rebate law.
I mean, I have to say, I think that this is a very sensible provision. I understand why pharma would have a problem with it, but as I think the number of times that a new drug comes on the market in a where we are only looking at our Medicaid population, and that new drug is the only thing that's going to save a person's life, and there's nothing available on the market that can possibly do that patient any good, I can't think of a time in my entire career when that's happened, regardless of a patient's insurance status, and I can't think of many other physicians who could say that, where they've actually run into problems. I mean, I'm just really puzzled by this concern that you have. Madam Chair, I think this is a perfectly sensible provision, the way the bill is constructed as it stands, and I don't think we're going to be in trouble if we pass it in this form.
Okay. Well, yeah. Okay. Senator Shields.
I'm just trying to track this on OLIS. Were there any amendments in the House at all?
No. We did not present any amendments in the House.
So the only amendments that are out there are dash one and dash three.
I haven't seen dash three.
Oh, I thought you. So the dash one is yours.
Yes.
Okay.
And I just want to put on the record the provisions of the bill that permits OHA to deny payment for a prescription drug for up to 6 months following approval by the FDA, allowing the Medicaid fee-for-service program to restrict coverage for up to 6 months for a new prescription drug following FDA approval, would provide time for the Pharmaceuticals and Therapeutics Committee to review the drug to recommend any prior authorization criteria, utilization controls, and if necessary, placement on the preferred drug list. So, okay. So what I'm,
I was wondering, this, how pharmaceuticals are reimbursed is a little beyond my area of expertise. Could you, either of you, walk me through how this works and who gets reimbursed? And and maybe you could put it into the CCO context, Josh, so that you can help me understand it.
May I respond quickly on the base question, which is this applies, this particular provision applies in the fee-for-service Medicaid context. So it governs how fee-for-service drugs are reimbursed, and they're paid, the pharmacies are reimbursed by OHA.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Shields, I won't pretend to be an expert on how the reimbursement rates for the CCOs and how they pay pharmaceuticals and those types of issues. I honestly don't know, and unless I got more details, I don't even think I can take a guess. Sorry about that.
Madam Chair, follow-up?
Yes.
And so, Jim, what you're arguing is that this is not just a DMAP question. This is the entire CCO Medicaid.
No. Madam Chair, thank you for that answering that question, Chip. No, for this particular, this bill is really in two parts. One part is the eligibility to participate in the OPDP. And the second part of the bill is the six-month window of deniability, and that applies, as this bill is written, only within the fee-for-service Medicaid context.
Okay. The DMAP count.
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes. And I just want to read one more last sentence on the fiscal. This provision of the bill may reduce the medical assistance program's exposure for reimbursement on high-cost new medications without restrictions, leading to expensive therapies that are neither medically necessary nor appropriate. However, any potential reduction of expenses cannot be determined. So I'm seeing what they're saying, that that six-month window would give them that time. All right.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Gardner, why didn't you guys offer any amendments on the House side?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, we were still deliberating the potential impact of this particular, the six-month window.
Really?
Okay. So I need to get a sense from where the committee is at. I would like to move the bill without the amendment, but if the committee desires to move it with the amendment, we can certainly do that too.
Madam Chair, I'd like to give it a little more thought. Can I ask one more question to Josh?
Yes.
So, Josh, the most important piece is the first piece, the OPDP piece. That's for you. You're not so much engaged in the six-month window piece.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Shields, actually, we would support and actually like to see the second piece also stay in place. We think the bill as is the most appropriate that, and I think the key here is the May part. It gives also the fee-for-service the folks who are doing the fee-for-service population the ability to manage those drugs, because at the end of the day, we do live in a global budget, and any money that is actually more and more money that's being taken to pay for fee-for-service is money that we can't necessarily pay for providers and for other innovative services that we're doing on the coordinated care side.
We don't have the paperwork to move it today.
Yeah, we do.
We do?
We do.
Not with the
amendment.
Not if we have the amendment.
Not if we do the amendment, but if we don't, we'll do the amendment.
Okay, well, let's give Senator Shields some time to think about it, unless someone else would like to go with or without the amendment. Where are you, Senator Knope?
I think I'd go with the amendment, but I want to see a little bit more.
But we couldn't move it with the amendment. All right.
I want to go without.
Yeah. But let's make sure that since the amendment just came forward, that we will Just delay the bill. Sign it up for.
I'm wondering, Madam Chair, if we could ask Elsie for an opinion on whether we would have the issue that Mr. Gardner spoke to.
Okay, we can do that also. So let's bring Elsie here. Thank you very much, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2638. And I would hate to lose this bill. Because the first part is extremely important. And it is the OHA. Oh, I did already close. Is OHA in the room?
Let's have OHA, someone from Medicaid, who, or from, who's the group? The therapeutics group.
From the Health Evidence Review Commission, or the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Commission?
Yeah, the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Commission.
Okay.
See if they have any input. Okay. All right, that is closed. And colleagues, no one is here to testify on House Bill 3139. I'll open a public hearing, and then I'll just close it if no one really cares about this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3139A defines the mobile medical clinic. It specifies that health professionals should be licensed by the appropriate licensing board. It establishes criteria for mobile medical clinics to be nonprofits and, with the permission of the private property owner, be located for 180 days or less. There is no amendment and no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
So no one's here to testify. I don't really want to move the bill unless there's someone out in the audience that really thinks this is a fantastic bill. Okay, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3139, and are we done? And we are adjourned. This one is strong.